Shalom and thank you for listening to Progressively Jewish. For Rosh Chodesh Tevet, we chose the theme of death and rebirth. I'm delighted to introduce to you our guests. Our first guest is Sharon Rose. Sharon lost her 14-year-old daughter Emily to suicide 10 years ago. She works for the Compassionate Friends, a peer-to-peer support charity set up over 50 years ago for bereaved parents whose child has died at any age and of any cause. Sharon coordinates support retreats for bereaved parents and siblings over the age of 18. Our next guest is Rabbi Dr. Michael Hilton, author, campaigner, scholar, teacher, and tutor in classical Greek at Leoberg College. And our last guest is Reverend Bruce Thompson, a Methodist minister, author, and blogger, and is currently serving in Lincolnshire. He has ministered alongside people who have experienced trauma and bereavement, including refugees and survivors of massacres in the Kosovan War of 1999.
This month, when we are marking the beginning of the month of Tevet, we are living through the shortest day of the year, as well as experiencing the hibernation of nature around us. According to the statistics, this period in our calendar year is one of the hardest for people to get through. Do you think urbanization has so distanced us from the rhythms of the seasons that we are less likely to appreciate the death and rebirth in nature? Can I ask Michael first, please?
Well, thank you, Tanya. And it's so great to be back on Progressively Jewish. It's such a fascinating program, and every podcast is really a treat to listen to. This question, in a way, feels quite personal for me because the main bereavements in my life, the loss of my father, my mother, my sister, all happened at this time of year. So my general answer is so linked with my personal life. We may be distanced from nature, from green things, from knowing where our food comes from, but I don't think we're distanced from the rhythm of the seasons. I mean, we all notice in Britain this dark time of year. The day that John Donne, the poet, called "Scarce 7 hours herself unmasks." That was his poem on St. Lucy's Day. And interestingly enough, in that poem, he links that darkness with death. And we see it all around us when the leaves fall from the trees. And we immediately start looking forward to when spring comes. And actually, in our Jewish calendar, we place the start of spring at Tu Bishvat, which is now, I think, only 6 weeks away. But our winters in Britain are a lot longer than that. But we need hope, don't we, in that darkness? And I think that's why it's been such a time of feasting for people. It's why people rush to the shops the moments the clocks go back and the afternoons are dark. In the Talmud, there's two opinions about how the Hanukkah candle should be lit. There's a school of Shammai who say you should light 8 on the first night and then go down. And then there's the school of Hillel who do it the way we do. You light 1 on the first night and then go up. And a friend of mine last year told me that he tried lighting the candles the Shammai way. And I said to him, "You going to do it again?" He said, "No." Somehow it doesn't work. We need light to be a symbol of hope. And when you're going from lightness into darkness, that's not celebration. And even in dark times, we need those little candles to increase and get more and more and prevail. I don't know what you think, Bruce, but that's just the way I see it.
Well, I mean, thank you, Michael. Fascinating. The manner in which the Hanukkah candles are lit is comparable, I think, to the candles of Advent in the Christian church, in that we begin on the first Sunday of Advent with one candle, and the second week 2, 3, 4, and then eventually on Christmas Day, the fifth candle. So we're going from darkness to light. And I think that that's a very comparable example. And it was only yesterday that I discovered that the School of Shammai had suggested that it go from 8 to 1. And when I heard that yesterday, we were at JCOS, and the introduction to the lighting of the Hanukkah candles was preceded with this introduction. And I thought how depressing that would be to go from 8 to 1, because I think the celebration should increase as the miracle increases. You know, the knowledge of the miracle, the awareness that this is actually working. So we go from 1, have we still got enough oil to last another night? No, we've got enough for 2, we've got enough for 3, we've got enough for 4. And that kind of, that resonates, I think, with those who experience the darkness of this time, and also the grief, death and bereavement, that we do begin in a place of that is really low. And then we come through to a point where we haven't come to terms with it, but we've somehow gone through it. We can never get over it, but we can come through it. And I find that very, very powerful, that we increase the light from the darkness to a better place. I'm not entirely sure that being distanced or urbanization diminishes our appreciation of death and rebirth in nature. I personally find that the more we are linked to the cycle of the seasons, the more likely we are to perhaps cope with some of the strong issues that come our way, the challenges that threaten to overwhelm us. I think, you know, the religious festivals, as we know, are so often timed to coincide with planting and reaping, the solstice and so on. And the secular world has ridden on the back of those festivals. For example, you don't have to be religious to have a spending spree in December to overcome the gloom. And that's a kind of secular approach to this dark period. And then, of course, we get, you know, children in need. Probably one of the latest secular festivals, where it's an opportunity to be generous at a time of austerity. There is this austerity, and we have to overcome it by sharing what we have. So I think there are secular ways in which we cope with this. But like all rabbis and ministers, I've ministered alongside many people facing death. And I've been fortunate to be in both inner city work and rural work, very rural work. And generally speaking, and it can only be generally speaking, those who have not been attached to a religious community but have been close to the land have somehow been embracing of the inevitability of death, sometimes more so than those who have not been so close to Earth's natural cycle. And that has tended to be so too with the loved ones who have travelled with them in their final earthly journey. As I say this in only general terms, but of course the religious have always seemed to tend to have a greater willing to embrace that journey, however hard it is. And it comes as a massive blow to us, however religious or not we are, because it seems so final. But I do personally, and it is only personal, and it may be true for others, that the recognition that Earth is somehow hibernating at this time, and that at some point the blossom will come again. And I find that very, very powerful metaphor. Thank you.
Bruce, can I then ask you, do you think that our disconnection from the nature cycle of birth and decay, of life and death, make us more scared of death, following your reflection on people who belong to community and not belong to community, and a sort of modern society?
Well, it's long ago when I was a teenager and I heard a preacher say that the great taboo these days is death. And I still think that is pretty well true for all sorts of reasons. And it may well be that we will want to consider the ways in which we approach death these days and kind of clinicalize it. For those who are dying, the terminally ill are put in a hospice or a hospital and they're taken away from the home. And I think, you know, the fact that when it's less anonymous, when it's less close and personal, and it becomes even more difficult. It's difficult at any time, we know that, but it becomes even more so, I think, because of the urbanization. And, you know, just cities that don't have the trees, tree-lined avenues, those who have to live in places where there are no tree-lined avenues, where there are no gardens, and it is a box in which we live, and the anonymity of it all and the distance of it all cannot help, and the pollution of the skies and the failure to see the transition of the moon, all of that kind of divorces us from, I think we need the rhythm, which is why I have such high regard for Judaism and its upkeeping of the Shabbat, which is so much been lost. The Sabbath has been so much lost in Christian church, that the kind of we get wrapped up in an endless cycle of run, but to actually just pause on a Friday evening and rest, and it's the end of a week. And I think that's interesting in itself, that Jewish communities rest. Shabbat is at the end of, and there's a pause, whereas the Christian Sabbath is the beginning of a week, and it's like, let's get ready for Monday. So we don't have that kind of pause, perhaps, that has sustained the Jewish community in the same way.
I wonder what Michael has got to say from the Jewish point of view as a rabbi.
Well, thank you. I think that when I've had the privilege of sitting with people who are dying, by and large, they're not actually scared. I think it's pain that people are scared of, not death itself. People are really worried. And of course, sadly, some people do die in great pain or from trauma, and that's really, really horrible. But most people, if it's a slowish process, if it's not too fast, they do reach a moment of acceptance where that sense of being are scared or even worried has gone away. Of course, the relatives may be scared and worried, often more so than the person who's actually dying. And I think this feeling we have as a society that we're scared of death is because we've become unused to it. We haven't had the scourge of a world war, not in my lifetime. We haven't had mass deaths, thank God. And the more distance we are from it, the more scary it can seem. But I'm reminded of famous quotes attributed to Isaac Asimov, the American science fiction writer of Russian Jewish parentage, who said, "Life is pleasant, death is peaceful. It's the transition that's troublesome."
That's beautiful. Thank you very much. Sharon, I wonder whether you got some comments.
Well, it was when you were talking about nature and sort of the inevitability. It's all very well when an older person dies, because yes, there's an inevitability. We always expect an older person to die. The work that I do is involved mainly with not necessarily younger death, but death which is not in the normal sequence. I work with a charity that supports bereaved parents and bereaved siblings and bereaved grandparents. So when nature carries on in its normal way, sometimes that can feel almost like a personal insult to parents who have lost their child, because it does feel so out of the normal order of things. So, yeah. I've come across many parents who, you know, have hated the change of the seasons, who don't want to see the spring begin because it's so painful. I do think, yeah, in saying that, it changes, but at the very beginning, it can almost feel like, yeah, life is carrying on, the seasons are carrying on, Christmas is coming, Hanukkah is coming, there are, you know, things to enjoy when it's so hard to enjoy those things. And even watching flowers grow, you know, it's hard to grow things at first.
I think I absolutely 100% agree with Sharon there. You know, when when it is a child who dies, however young or old that child is. I've even, particularly so perhaps, with someone of mature years who's lost a child, it's the wrong way round, they've said. I've heard that so often from a range of parents of different ages. It's the wrong way round. So that cycle has been broken, and perhaps it's, you know, it drives home even more the pain and the loss and the insecurity and the fear of what has happened. There's somehow a double blow here when a child dies, however young or old that child is. So I absolutely agree with Sharon entirely. That cycle of the inevitability is somehow broken in those occasions.
And we need to remember, I think, all the time, how hard the festive season is for people who are lonely, for people who are troubled, bereaved, for people who are just not in a mood to celebrate, for people who don't have an opportunity to celebrate. There's a very strong and good tradition in the Jewish community of people volunteering at Christmas, from the doctors and nurses who go into work in the hospitals, to those who help in the homeless charities and many others. It's long-standing in Anglo-Jewry and it still goes on. A day when we're not celebrating in quite the same way, though we of course also like to spend time with our families. But it's a day of reaching out to help and help those people who at the end of December this year, like every December, are going to feel really in need. And if a podcast can do any good at all, it can. It's an opportunity to say hello and think of such people and say, yes, you know, we are aware, we are thinking of you, and you can get help.
No, absolutely. Thank you very much to all of you. I thought it were very thoughtful and a wonderful contribution, leading us to the next part of our conversation about not just death in our human existence, in our human life, but also to a death of a loved one, and particularly such tragedies, which, as Sharon described, happening in our lives. And I want to ask Sharon you the next question. A death of a loved one is always a tragedy, which leaves many of us bereaved and inconsolable, as you mentioned. How can we carry on our lives in a constructive and a positive way, honoring the memory of our loved ones at the same time as well?
I think what I try to do always and encourage other people to do is almost enable one another to grieve, talk about our loved one, acknowledge the grief that we are experiencing. And we're talking about, you know, carrying on our lives in a constructive and positive way. You know, we might not feel like doing that at first, because, you know, when we grieve, when we've lost somebody that we love, sometimes it feels as though life isn't worth living anymore because our life has changed so much. I think if we give ourselves time to grieve, if we allow ourselves to talk to other people, if people talk to us about our loved one, about our child, our brother, our sister, our parent, in time, it becomes less painful and more beautiful. You know, I suppose in Jewish religion, we have Shiva, you know, which is, you know, often a time to talk about somebody who's died. When it's a younger person, it's much harder. I think sometimes we try to almost fast forward grief too much. You know, we try to be too positive too quickly. Yeah, we live in such a fast, you know, talking about urbanization before, we live in such a fast world. We think, okay, people expect somebody has died, okay, you know, with a parent, I think we say Kaddish for a year. For a child, I think we say Kaddish for a month. Is that right? I think your grief isn't over after that amount of time. so we can't fast forward it. Yeah. We may be grieving for the whole of our lives, and that's okay. But we will find lovely things to say about our loved ones.
Yes, I think when Sharon just mentioned there the rapidity of life, the desire to move on from where we are all the time, whether it, in whatever circumstances, we seem to be in a rush, and we can't rush bereavement. Rabbi Michael mentioned earlier about the festivals and how hard it is to get through the festivals. We carry with us those memories of lighting candles or exchanging gifts or being around a meal table, a birthday, an anniversary, whatever it may be. And so often people have said to me that it's actually in the second year, it's even more difficult because you kind of build yourself up to get through the first round of anniversaries. But by the time we come to the second round of anniversaries, things haven't changed. The person we love still isn't round the table. They're still not lighting candles. So it really reinforces the fact that life is always going to be like this from now on. And so to actually think that we can get through this in a month, 6 months or a year, that's absolutely impossible.
I find it very hard to generalize because I think everybody's bereavement journey is different. Our personalities are different. Our resilience can be very, very different. The ability that we have to cope. Some people cope amazingly who you never thought would, and others just, you know, it's the reverse. And when my dear sister, younger than me, took her own life, I was carried forward by a massive wave of anger. Not with her, a little bit with her perhaps, but much more with the mental health services who'd let her down. And I spent my days documenting in great detail every tiny thing they got wrong and sent them the whole lot. It was nearly 20 pages, single spaced. All credit to them, they took my complaint really seriously. Now, of course, it didn't bring her back, but in the end, that thing that I did in my anger was constructive. And I'm still, to this day, actively involved in the mental health campaigning that sprang from that time. So forgive me answering in a very personal way, but I do think everybody's experience is different, and that was mine.
Thank you so, so much to all of you for sharing your thoughts. And I just would like to come back to Sharon and Bruce for more comments on what Michael just said.
Yes, Michael, I'm so sorry that you lost your sister to suicide. I also lost my daughter to suicide. I think what you're saying about people grieving in different ways, raising awareness, raising money for charity, is definitely a way that some people manage to get through those first months, days, months, years, because it gives them a focus. What we've found in our charity is that it often comes to bite you on the bum. You know, you have to grieve, you have to, I think that grieving is doing, but you still have to give yourself that time to be really, really sad because, yeah, it's a terrible thing that's happened. It's such a sad thing. But yes, I think you're so right. People get through in different ways, and we have to accept that and do that. I also wanted to just say that, you were saying also that there isn't a pattern and it's different, you know, because I think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came up with, stages of grieving. There's anger, there's acceptance. It doesn't work in any specific order, and it might not happen at all. And you might keep going back to one of those stages that you were at before, and that's fine. You know, I think we all have to grieve in our own way.
Yes, those stages of grief are flexible, aren't they? Elizabeth Kubler-Ross puts it down, and some people seem to think that you will go from shock, denial, anger, acceptance, over a period, and it's all kind of neatly spaced out, but it's not, because as you rightly say, Sharon, it somehow gets mixed up and suddenly we're back to shock or we're back to denial. What part of Rabbi Tanya's question is about turning something into positive, and both yourself, Sharon, and Michael have turned those terrible, tragic experiences in your own life into something positive. I wonder if I could share with you a couple of briefly examples of two young people who experienced extraordinary circumstances. Firstly, I was very privileged in 1999 to work with Kosovan refugees during the Kosovan War of the summer of 1999. And one of the families, five children had survived a massacre of 16 children from Serb paramilitaries. And the eldest was Saranda. She was just 15. And she was always a remarkable character, but within a few years, she was able to talk about her experience to school children and challenge the prejudice and the hostility and the hatred. And now, 22 years on, she's vice president of Kosovo and is now has channeled that experience into challenging her own community about domestic violence, violence towards women. So not just inter-ethnic conflict and strife, but even within her own community. And the other person I want to share with you is a young man, Adam Fouracre, who in 2006 had his brother murdered on the eve of his 18th birthday. He was beaten to death by four young men who'd been drinking too heavily. And I heard of, he was in the town where I was serving as minister in Taunton, Somerset. And he began a petition to make Taunton Street safer. And I invited him round to have a coffee and we had a chat. And he was reluctant at first, but within a very short space of time, he too began sharing his experience with 15, 16, 17 year old school children to say, you know, this happened because somebody drank too much and it all got out of hand. And he's recently published a book on that. And he remembers me saying, I'd forgotten this, but apparently I said that, you know, when a tragedy happens, for example, someone is killed outside your road in a road traffic accident, you could either just ignore it, you could become angry and take it out on the person who's perhaps killed or injured your family member, or you can campaign for road safety. And what both of those have done have turned those tragic incidents into major campaigns that have changed people's lives, and it's immeasurable. We won't know how many lives have been changed. What we do know is that they've had an impact. And likewise for the tremendous work you do, Sharon and Rabbi Michael, in your response to your own tragedies.
Yeah, and absolutely.
If you look at the people who work for such charities and indeed in campaigns and you talk to them, you will find so many of them have that personal link. There was an MP called Toby Jessel, Jewish MP, who was one of the people behind seatbelts being made compulsory for children. He'd lost his own child in a car accident. He had that personal investment and he would not drop this. And the Tory party, lots of them were really against it. And he was a strong conservative, but he got that bill through. It's just, you know, that personal commitment to something is so important and comes out of our experiences.
That's actually a message of hope for me, listening to you. You know, in the moment of darkness, of personal darkness, going through a loss of bereavement, that the depth of one's grief turned into action actually changes the world. And that's probably the best gift you and we and everyone who's mourning can give to the world and to the memory of their loved ones by doing such an amazing work and in the world of living. And what I want to ask you, my last question to you, because I found it so moving and so inspirational personally, that probably we have at least one of our listeners who's going through a very hard time right now, either struggling with the loss of their loved ones or struggling with the darkness of the season. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say, keep talking and talking and talking and talking. If you don't have anyone around, look for someone. If you don't have family, look for a friend or a neighbor, or find a counselor or ring a helpline. If you're in the UK, we do have a Jewish counseling service with very strong links to our progressive Jewish community, the Raphael Counseling Service. And the helpline number is 0800 234 6236, 0800 234 6236. It's really important that when we have a program like this, that we don't leave you with nowhere to go afterwards. And of course, as we are a small world and we're not the BBC, you can always contact us as well.
I want to say two things. One to the person that you've indicated, Rabbi Tanya, someone who may be experiencing death and bereavement at the moment. I cannot know how you're feeling right now, and that's important for you to hear. I cannot know how you are feeling, and it's not possible for anyone to put themselves in your shoes. Even though I've experienced death and bereavement in my life, I don't know how you're feeling. So that's what I want to say to someone who's experiencing that. What I also want to say is to someone who is perhaps sitting alongside someone who is in death and bereavement at the moment, and that is this little saying, a thousand words may not be enough, but one may be one too many. So just be with them in silence. Just be there and receptive to whatever may be thrown at you, and hold on with them and walk beside them into the future.
Yeah, I wanted to say that the charity that I work with, we're called the Compassionate Friends, and we are peer-to-peer support. We're not professionals. We are fellow bereaved parents. We are fellow bereaved siblings who will listen and share, and sharing our loved ones. And as you said, Michael, talking and talking, that's what helps the most. I can give you our helpline number. We have a helpline that's open 365 days a year, every day. It's 0345 123 2304. And your call will be answered by a fellow, a bereaved parent. So this isn't for everybody. This is for bereaved parents who've lost a child of any age and by any cause. We also have, we can be contacted by from our website, which is www.tcf.org.uk. It's what you're saying, Bruce, as well, you know, being alongside somebody. We can't make it better. We don't know how somebody's feeling. All we can do is be there and understand. And sometimes if we don't know what to say, don't say anything. Yeah, platitudes don't work, and God sometimes doesn't work, religion sometimes doesn't work, because we may have been the people with incredible faith beforehand, but once a terrible thing has happened, we may lose all our faith, or we may find faith. It once again, it changes. I'm Jewish, but when my daughter died, I actually wanted to go into a church because I thought they would understand somehow. You know, in my synagogue, they wouldn't understand because they knew me. They knew, my daughter. But I wanted to go to somebody who didn't know her somehow, and who could, even though I didn't really believe, I wanted somebody who did believe to do my, to be there for me. So grief is muddled.
Thank you very much. It's very personal and very powerful. And I would like to really thank the three of you being so open and honest, and that energy is quite soothing, and I actually found it quite cathartic just listening to the three of you. And to our listeners, I would like to say that if you're struggling if you're in a really difficult place, just follow the advice of Sharon, Michael and Bruce. Don't do it on your own. There are services out there. There are people who care about you. Please reach out. And I would like just to repeat that you can find the Compassionate Friends, who work with bereaved parents, on the website www.tcf.org.uk. And their helpline is 0345 123 2404. And the Raphael Center, the Jewish Counseling Service, can be contacted by the following phone number: 0800 2346 236. And I would like to thank the three of you for a wonderful time on this podcast and giving hope in the time of darkness to me and our listeners. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This podcast was presented by Rabbi Tanya Sachnovich, and I would like to thank our guests, Reverend Bruce Thompson, Rabbi Michael Hilton, and Sharon Rose, for speaking so frankly and movingly on our podcast today. The Compassionate Friends helpline phone number we have given you has a mistake in it. The correct number is 03-451-232304. I would also like to thank Liberal Judaism, Reform Judaism and Lehrberg College for supporting Progressively Jewish. Please share your thoughts with us on the Progressively Jewish Facebook page or by emailing us at progressivelyjewish@gmail.com.